I'd like to now call the next case, Jason Omar Griffith versus the State of Nevada, case number 66312. Yes, of course. Ready to proceed, Mr. Waters?
I am. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Giacomo, how are you today? All right. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Justice Pickering, Hardesty, and Seda. My name is William Waters. I'm an attorney at the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Jason Griffith in this appeal. With me at council table is Abel Yanez, who was the trial attorney.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Griffith was convicted after a jury trial, which did not comport with established notions of due process. And the reason why his trial did not comport with notions of due process was based on judicial decisions at the prompting of the state, which affected Mr. Griffith's right to remain silent, his right to counsel, his right to present evidence in his own defense, his right to cross-examine witnesses against him, his right to be present when the jury seeks clarification regarding a rather significant point of fact with respect to manslaughter. So the case really begins earlier than when we're in the middle of trial, when I think that the state rather adeptly creates a narrative about what this case is about through, before the case even got to court, the media had already portrayed Jason as an abusive ex-boyfriend. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing came out at trial to show that he had prior abuse or prior allegations, either here in New York where he's from or anywhere. Jason Griffith had no prior criminal record prior to this trial, but I think what happened was Jason became the abusive ex-boyfriend. Deborah became the innocent victim, girlfriend who just loved him too much. And the case sort of proceeded from there. And you get to a point where the court is ignoring highly probative and relevant evidence to support Mr. Griffith's theory of defense. And I believe it was based on this sort of narrative that had occurred. And that, because Mr. Yanez litigated a lot of this prior to trial, he was trying very desperately to show that Deborah's prior behavior could affect Mr. Griffith's mental state on the night that she died, and with an eye towards being able to present that to the jury so that Mr. Griffith wouldn't have to testify. Now you get to in the middle of trial, and Mr. DiGiacomo comes up with what I perceive as a rule that's found nowhere in Nevada law, that in self-defense cases, before you can present any evidence, any relevant evidence, which, by the way, relevant evidence just has any tendency whatsoever, it's a very low standard, Mr. DiGiacomo creates a rule which the judge agreed with, that no, in self-defense cases, you have to get on the witness stand first, say magic words like, I was afraid of this person at the moment that this happened, and once you do that, then otherwise, in the state's opinion, then corroborative evidence is then allowed. And they relied on Daniel, and we all know Daniel. Daniel was factually very different, and Daniel was a pure evidentiary issue, which was there was no question the defendant was going to testify in Daniel, and he did testify in Daniel, and then it became the issue was, I believe it was Judge Mosley at the time, restricted Mr. Daniel's ability to then ask or present his other witnesses that would have corroborated his own testimony. And so there's language in Daniel about, well, this is corroborative evidence, the defendant has the right to present corroborative evidence, but it never said that a victim's prior violent acts committed to the defendant is only corroborative evidence.
This appeal raises a very interesting question that I was actually surprised, it doesn't seem like we have addressed in our jurisprudence, and that is the point at which the defense is required, if at all, to indicate its intention to pursue a self-defense defense.
Right.
Runyon, Hill, Daniel don't seem to address that rather interesting question.
Well,
and so I'm interested in having counsel comment about this. You have couched the argument, if I understand your argument correctly, in terms of an invasion of the defendant's Fifth Amendment protection.
Absolutely.
Against self-incrimination. Probably it could also be viewed in the context of the defendant not having to really assert their position.
Right.
Until after the state has closed its
right.
Case in chief. But in this state, we impose on the state the burden of proof to demonstrate that the homicide is not excused because of self-defense. Mm-hmm. So is the state supposed to do that during their case in chief without knowing whether a self-defense is going to be asserted? Is it to do it when they're in the rebuttal case after the defense has asserted something? To me, it's a bit of a quandary, and I'm interested in your input on the legal question about this.
And it is an interesting question. One, I would say the defense never has to tell the state prior to trial, hey, this is the way we're going to pursue our case. And I don't think the state necessarily has to sit down with the defense and say, this is, we're going to lay out to you how we're going to process to prosecute your client. Here's the way I think.
But we do say the state has the burden to demonstrate
the
absence of a self-defense, but it wouldn't have to present that testimony if that defense isn't being asserted.
And the state always has a rebuttal case, always. Mm-hmm. Number two, what should happen is the state should present its case, and if they're smart enough to figure out that this is where we're going, because technically through cross-examination, you know, Mr. DeJockman is very talented. He'd know, like, sort of where we're leading to. But otherwise, you let the defendant present his case. This was admissible evidence. There was no prohibition on this evidence coming in prior to Mr. Griffith testifying. And you know what? If at the end of presentation of that evidence, they decide Mr. Griffith is not going to testify, if the judge says, you know what, I think you've met the minimum threshold to get a self-defense jury instruction, the state then has a chance to put on a rebuttal case. Number two, the judge could say, you know what, I don't think you've met the minimum threshold necessary to get a self-defense jury instruction. I'm not giving it to you. And the defendant still chooses not to testify at that point. Well, great. Then we can litigate whether the evidence was sufficient to warrant a jury instruction on appeal, but that's the decision the judge gets to make, because that's inherently a district court judge's discretion. Like, do I believe that the evidence has met the bare minimum threshold to get you a jury instruction? And then on appeal, if the judge...
Let me ask you this, because it seems like the context in which this arose was the defense's desire to cross-examine Colombo further.
Correct.
On evidence that would have provided more information that would support a self-defense, and they wanted to do so in the state's case in chief.
Absolutely.
The district court's ruling says, I'm not going to prevent you from eliciting that evidence. You can call Colombo on rebuttal or cross-examine him on rebuttal when I know that defense is going to be asserted. Why isn't that a reasonable ruling? How is the defense prejudiced by that ruling?
One, cross-examination is different than calling your own witness on direct examination, number one. You can ask to treat him as an adverse witness or whatever for calling in your case in chief. But factually then, and I'm glad you pointed it out, because then that proves your point, Your Honor. Everyone was aware of self-defense because Mr. Jockman raised this issue before he had even rested his case in chief. He said, I don't want them being able to cross-examine Colombo regarding specific violent acts known to Jason, which Colombo had witnessed, including her behavior literally 5 minutes before she died that night, because it's not relevant until he gets up on the witness stand. The judge's decision then violates his fundamental right to cross-examine someone giving adverse testimony against him. That is an important right. I mean, I understand, like, logically, like, yeah, okay, you could call him indirect in your own case in chief, but that's... Colombo wasn't necessarily a great witness. I think it's speculative to assume that he's going to give Mr. Yanez everything Mr. Yanez needs during direct examination. He was adverse to our client. And when you have a witness who's adverse to your client, the purpose is you're allowed to cross-examine them to really, really test them. I think it was an unreasonable suggestion on the judge's part, and in particular because that evidence was relevant at that point. It was relevant and it was admissible. And I think another point which the court completely ignored, in my estimation, and it's kind of astonishing to me because Mr. Yanez brought it up at least half a dozen times, is you have 48.061, which is the DV statute. And this was a domestic violence situation. Deborah committed domestic violence against Jason. And it was pervasive domestic violence against Jason, and it was for a long period of time. And I understand that Mr. DiGiacomo convinced Judge Delaney that because she had never committed a physical battery, in his mind, that wasn't domestic violence. But 33.018 says all of this stuff is domestic violence.
So your point is it's not a 48055 case,
exactly.
It's a 48061. I mean, I get the 48055,
right.
But the specific acts could come in under 061.
Absolutely. And I think that 48061 is plain on its face. You don't need to get to the legislative history, but let's go there. The legislature flat out said this is going to allow evidence, which otherwise was not admissible before, to be admissible now because we want battered women, protect them. I mean, it was a battered woman's thing, but I think it applies to both genders, quite frankly.
It's not gender specific.
Right.
I'm a little bit concerned about two other issues that are big to me, and you're getting dangerously close to the end of your time. I'm concerned about the question that came from the jury and the prosecutorial misconduct. Do you want to comment on that, or will you submit it on the briefs?
I do. I'll try to wrap it up because I am in my rebuttal time. Admittedly, I filed this brief before Manning had come out from this court, so I understand now. I had argued it was structural error. This court then issued an opinion in Manning which said failure to bring the parties in to address the jury question is not structural error. I would say in this case, under a plain error analysis, the error is plain from the record because the statute is mandatory. Bring them back in the court. Let's discuss it. And I do think that the error not only is plain, but it did affect a substantial right because this shows, that jury question is so hugely important because it shows the jury not only flatly rejected this nonsense about first-degree murder, but it really struggled with this idea of manslaughter and self-defense. So I think that that's hugely important. And I understand that, you know, the argument's going to be, well, why wouldn't Mr. Yanez bang on the courthouse door, demand to be let in that courtroom to, you know, put everything he wanted to on the record? But let's face it, you know, the judge, when she calls, she says, this is how I'm handling it. We respect judges when they say, this is the way we're going to do things. Now, with the prosecutorial misconduct, again, the prosecutorial misconduct occurs because they forced Mr. Griffith to testify. Let's face it. If he's not forced to testify, they can't call him a liar dozens of times in the rebuttal argument. And they can't say that he's a liar. They can't say that he lied about self-defense until he came up with this idea of self-defense on the first day of trial. By the way, I think it's interesting they'd say, well, it's harmless because he testified. He told Detective Long that he killed her in self-defense. But gee whiz. Okay, so he told her, but you're calling him a liar. So what is it? So it's not harmless because he told the jury that, well, I told Detective Long that I killed her in self-defense. But then you call him a liar and you say, but that's not harmless either. Obviously that's harmless. And I think this is hugely important. The state commented on evidence that they, or the lack of evidence, when they kept it out. That is particularly egregious. They knew Jason Griffith told that officer minutes after his arrest, I killed her in self-defense. Then they argue to the jury, he's making up self-defense at trial. This is the first time we've ever heard of it. And candidly, and respectfully, this idea that, well, I was just calling him a liar because he likes to lie to women. Like, no, look at what Mr. DiGiacomo said to the jury. Is there a single fact he didn't lie to you about? Well, that would encompass everything Mr. Griffith said to the jury about the circumstances surrounding Deborah's death. This wasn't, well, he's a liar and he likes to, you know, have a lot of women in his life and he likes to lie to them and juggle them. This was, his whole testimony is a lie. You cannot believe it. You cannot trust him. And then the pregnancy is important as well. They knew and they kept that information from the jury. They knew she was not pregnant in March and April. Yet they argue all throughout their rebuttal this narrative that he's a soulless, heartless cad whose poor, innocent, pregnant girlfriend, he just is manipulating her, mentally, like, abusing her, when, quite frankly, with all due respect to Deborah, she lied to him about her pregnancy, and there's a reason why she did that, and that was to maintain a relationship with him, keep him in her life. So this idea that Judge Delaney can say at the end of the case, like, this responsibility is totally yours, Mr. Griffin, you know, I mean, that's part of the narrative that the state was effectively able to portray, but it's absolutely not true. I have about a minute left. If there's nothing else, I'm going to try to save that 1 minute.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll give you an additional minute. You'll have two for rebuttal, and Mr. DiGiacomo will have 16 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
May it please the Court, my name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the state of Nevada in this action. I want to address sort of generally the last questions by Justice Sata first, because I think we can address those very quickly, because I agree with the Court that the main issue in this case is sort of how do we deal with this situation. Then it's a repeating situation that happens down in district court, and district court judges really have no guidance on it. And so it's a very good opportunity to address why it is this is a problem and why it is every other court has dealt with it the way Judge Delaney has dealt with it in this particular case. But let me talk first about the question from the jury. As far as I know, the statute that says, you know, bring them back to court, the question is what does that really mean? And ultimately, the judges in the HJD, it has happened that way for 20 years. You get on a conference call, you have a conversation. If nobody objects to having to go to court, you don't have to go to court. Why is that not waivable by the defendant? And in this case, his counsel said, I'm fine doing this over a conference call. There was a discussion. Everybody agreed that that's what was going to be said back to the jury. And that information was provided to the jury, and a record was made at the time of the verdict. Why is it that a defendant is not entitled to waive any particular portion of that statute? And I would suggest to you that it is waivable. Certainly it's not plain error because there was no objection to it, because that is something that I don't think anybody would have recognized is not something that a defense attorney can waive. As to the misconduct, the suggestion is that I created evidence and said, you know, the defendant testified and he's a liar. That would have been wholly inappropriate in a case where there was zero evidence. In this case, Mr. Griffith testified for a day and a half, and almost every single fact he testified to, he acknowledged on cross-examination, was a lie. What happened was he testifies, and then I have his text messages, and I painstakingly, over a day and a half, go through each one of his text messages, and to the point that on Friday afternoon, there was the what has been termed the Perry Mason on steroids moment, when the defendant acknowledges that to this jury, quote, you're a liar, correct? Yes, sir. And when you want something, you're more than willing to lie about it. Yes, sir. You're more than willing to say, on my sons, this is true. Yes, I have done that, sir. What Mr. Griffin is talking about is all the testimony that he gave to the jury during his direct examination by Mr. Yanez. He repeatedly acknowledged for a day and a half that he lied on direct examination. I was commenting on his testimony that he lied for a day and a half. As it relates to the suggestion that I said she wasn't pregnant, no, what I said was it was irrelevant. Jason Griffith believes she was pregnant, whether or not she's pregnant or not. And I don't know. Mr. Waters says, I know that she's not pregnant in April of 2010. I do know that she sought an abortion in March of 2010. Whether or not she was pregnant in April of 2010 may be physically impossible. I'm not sure. But what the evidence was that they wanted to argue to admit was some doctor told some detective that told some detective that wrote in a report that she wasn't pregnant. What was relevant about that? What was relevant other than to dirty up her particular character? So let's address the main issue in this case, which is what do you do when all of the evidence in your case in chief is a straight identification case? That's all it was. There wasn't a single piece of evidence that establishes that there was any act by the victim for either provocation or self-defense, and I don't think you have to split hairs as to whether it's admissible against one versus the other. In either case, it's an act by the victim that causes the defendant to react, and the question is that excusable or is that justified or is that manslaughter because it's provocative? There was not a single shred of evidence in the case in chief. And Mr. Waters suggested that we precluded the cross-examination of Mr. Colombo about the incident that occurred 5 minutes before. That's simply not true. He testified to going into the room. He testified that he saw her kind of in Jason's face pointing her finger and that Jason lunged and grabbed her by the throat, and he was allowed to be crossed on that information. I haven't gone back and read to see if he was crossed on that. What they wanted to then do was get into specific acts of the victim on cross-examination. That was beyond the scope of direct, which a judge certainly has the authority to decide is not the time period and force you to do that in your own case in chief when it becomes relevant. But you got to remember that both Daniel's type of evidence, and there's two types of Daniel evidence. There is the propensity evidence by reputation and opinion. That evidence can be admitted for sole propensity purposes. It is more than likely that she engaged in conduct similar to it. There's that evidence, and then there's the specific act. That specific act evidence isn't admissible for propensity purposes. It is admissible to corroborate the mindset of the defendant that he felt the need to act in self-defense. That's what Daniel says, that the specific act evidence is admissible. Well, if there is no evidence of an act that needs to be done in self-defense, then there's nothing relevant about that evidence. And 47070 controls. It is a conditioned precedent. It is a foundational requirement that there be some evidence of self-defense. And there was absolutely no evidence of self-defense. I never said to the district court, Jason Griffith has to testify in order to put on specific act evidence. I said there had to be some evidence of self-defense. Now, could there have been evidence in another manner had Colombo not left and he had been present and witnessed the crime? Sure, that would have been evidence of self-defense, and then you could put on the specific act evidence that you could establish the defendant knew about. Could there have been a videotape of the crime? Could there have been a separate witness of the crime? Could there have been a number of things? Yes. But in this particular case, there was no way for the defense to establish the foundational requirement to the admissibility of a condition precedent to admissibility.
And the opportunity to provide that evidence and by and through witnesses other than the defendant was, in fact, afforded to the defendant in this case.
Oh, my, yes. I mean, to the point where if you were to read the fact pattern that the defense presents, and for the most part it's based upon the direct testimony of Mr. Griffith that he acknowledged were a substantial number of lies, but ultimately if you were to read that fact pattern, the argument by them that somehow they weren't allowed to present evidence concerning this victim's behavior over a 12-month period, I mean, the entirety of this trial was spent discussing all of these things that allegedly she did wrong, even where it was not, they called it harassment, but some of it wasn't harassment. I mean, if you were to be told that, hey, meet me at my house, I'll take you to your abortion, and I happen to not be there, and I'm off at the South Point having sex with another woman, and I come back and say, hey, so sorry, and there is a yelling match between you, and the police are called, and she's left the house, and then he sends a text message, want to have makeup sex, and he suggests that that was harassing behavior. That all came in. I mean, all of this comes in over and over and over and over again. All of this evidence that they say under 48061 should be admissible came in. But they're suggesting to you under 48061 this evidence is admissible absent self-defense. But that's the whole purpose of 48061. That's what it says, is if you have a defense of self-defense, all this evidence is admissible. And he's right. Under 48061, it all came in, but the foundational requirement had to be laid. And in this case, that foundational requirement, much like we cited in Melendez in our brief and what every court says, sometimes the foundation is solely the defendant has to testify, and it's nothing to do with a Brooks error or a structural error. It just happens to be a fact pattern that you're rough with, that fact pattern being that there must be evidence of self-defense.
I understand that, and I wanted to ask you about this specifically, that at volume 7, 1414 of the record, you are quoted as, the state is quoted, I think it's you, are quoted as saying, without this defendant's testimony, there will be no instruction on self-defense. And if there is no instruction on self-defense, then her propensity for violence isn't relevant. It has no relevancy whatsoever, and if there is no relevancy, the court shouldn't allow it in. What concerns me, first of all, I don't know if you even remember
that
part of the transcript.
That sounds exactly like a statement that I would have made.
Sounds like,
I think I just said that.
Sounds like Mr. DiGiacomo.
It does.
My concern about that is I'm not sure that it's the case that it is essential to a self-defense that the defendant must testify to a self-defense.
It's not.
Okay.
And I think that's what I was trying to explain to you just earlier is...
Well, you do say, without this defendant's testimony, there will be no instruction on self-defense, and I have a concern with that statement.
Correct, and I'm taking this two different ways, Your Honor. When I make that statement, I'm talking about factually, in this case, there is no way for a self-defense instruction to be given. I have tried many cases, and I don't think that it's the rule that a defendant must testify in a self-defense case.
Okay.
So I don't mean the court to take what I said there to be a broad rule. I was talking factually in this case, I guess theoretically some of the witness could have come forward that they were hiding in the closet and they saw it. But I mean, other than that, based upon the facts that I'm aware of in this case, there was no ability for this defendant to get an instruction on self-defense absent presenting evidence of it, and the only person who could was Jason Griffith.
Because the other evidence had already been presented, and given the course of the trial, it had not been thus far elicited. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Through the entire trial, it was solely identification. The only statements admitted were, I didn't do it, it wasn't me, I had nothing to do with this, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then there was evidence of, she traveled to the house, she never left the house, and her cell phone, her car gets dumped, and her cell phone gets taken down to this was solely who did it. The question of what crime was, in this essence, is there going to be a self-defense claim, did not come up until the defense case. There was simply zero evidence of self-defense at the end of the state's case in chief. And it would have been, and just imagine the nightmare on the other side. Because the one thing we can't control is defendants, right? At the end of the day, they get to make the call. So if a lawyer represents, hey, look, judge, I'm going to put on the witness to establish the conspiracy, so I'd like to be able to get in these co-conspirator statements up front, and you can always strike them later on if for some reason I don't get this witness on. The court can rely upon that representation, but imagine it being the defendant saying, yeah, I'm going to testify to self-defense, so now they get to put in every bad thing the victim's ever done in her entire life, and then he gets all that evidence in and goes, hey, no way, I'm not testifying, and then the court goes back, what, and strikes the irrelevant evidence that has now been put before the jury. The state's left in a position to make a motion for a mistrial and hope that this court finds there was manifest necessity for it. I mean, there has to be a rule that says there be some evidence of self-defense foundationally before you're allowed in the corroborative character evidence to corroborate the defense of self-defense. And if you do not have any evidence of that defense, you do not get to corroborate it. I know I have very few seconds left. I just wanted to mention one thing because it disturbed me in the appellant's brief as it relates to the motion to suppress. Their request and their motion to suppress was suppress Dan Long's statement on the way to CCDC. And they didn't want to suppress everything else Jason said, except for they wanted redacted the two times that he invoked to a specific question, but then in the defense brief cuts it off, doesn't finish what he says. I won't answer that question with my lawyer, but if there's anything else you guys want to ask me, I'll talk to you about it, and then the interviewer goes on, and he does that a second time, and their request was take those two out and suppress Dan Long because asking for your lawyer's phone number at the end is an invocation. We redacted those two portions that they requested, and we decided we're not going to put in Dan Long's statement. And they say Dan Long's statement was, quote, that he killed her in self-defense, and it wasn't. The record will reflect that what Dan Long said is he said to him, man, she was just talking and talking and talking. I snapped. And with his hands behind his back, kind of made a circle like he strangled her neck. It wasn't, she came at me with a gun and it was self-defense. That's not what he told Detective Long. And then when Detective Long asks, will you go on tape and tell me the full story, he declines. We decided, out of a risk of not having this statement being placed into evidence, that was their request, was suppress that statement. We didn't offer it, and now their brief is suggesting that somehow we were devious in not offering the statement that they sought suppression of. And that seemed to be inappropriate in reading this particular brief. If there is no other questions from the court, I see I have about a minute left, but I don't know if there's any other questions of the court.
I don't have any. Do my colleagues? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Waters, a couple more minutes.
I know that there's a lot to get to, so I'm going to try to do it as quickly as I can.
Sure.
First of all, Dan Long's statement, I don't know what Mr. Giacomo is talking about. If you go to the grand jury transcripts in this case, which are part of the record, this is what Dan Long testified to at the grand jury. Jason told me on the car ride to CCDC, you know I didn't plan this, man. She attacked me, and she ended up dead. That's self-defense. She attacked me, I reacted, and she ended up dead. That was the statement that Dan Long testified to at the grand jury. That's what Jason told me on the car ride to CCDC. Number two, this notion that Mr. Griffith admitted that all of his testimony had been a big lie is nonsense. I'm sorry, with all due respect to Mr. DiGiacomo, he admitted he lied to women. Of course he did. I mean, he's not perjuring himself. Yes, he lied to women in order to have sexual relations with them. Mr. Yanez pointed that out in closing argument. Does that mean he's a murderer because he lied to various women in his life? He's not a liar about everything. Yes, he acknowledges he lied to women. Mr. DiGiacomo took that way beyond what Mr. Griffith testified to and said he's lied about every fact in this case. And respectfully, Mr. Griffith never admitted on the witness stand, well, yes, I've lied about everything so far. The pregnancy, the non-pregnancy, was in a police report. Okay, there's a statute that says a factual finding in a police report is admissible against the state. Who knows if she was or she wasn't? She wasn't. The cops certainly thought she wasn't, and we trust them to do, like, thorough investigations. They thought that fact was true. They put it in a police report. It should have come in. And not allowing it to come in doesn't give the state the right to say, well, of course she was pregnant in April, when they know, at the very least, there's a major question about whether that's true or not. Okay? And this idea that, like, well, it's irrelevant, why do you mention it then? You're mentioning it. It's so irrelevant. Why do you keep bringing it up? Because you're portraying Jason as a heartless, soulless cad who doesn't care about his pregnant girlfriend. Her behavior, Deborah's behavior, did come in the state's case in chief. Columbo testified during direct examination, I've seen her get violent with Jason in the past. Now, he didn't mention necessarily specific instances, but that's enough. This idea that there has to be some evidence of the exact singular moment when Jason kills her to justify self-defense, you can present circumstantial evidence. A week earlier, she pulled a gun on Jason. Is Mr. DiGiacomo suggesting that we couldn't present that evidence through another witness because it's just completely irrelevant to what was going on in his mind at the time that she died? It's absolutely relevant as to what's going on in his mind. And again, let him present his evidence. If the district court judge feels like those seven witnesses didn't establish enough to get him a self-defense jury instruction, then he doesn't get it. Mr. DiGiacomo is creating a burden on the defendant that the state doesn't have. They can convict the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt based solely on circumstantial evidence, yet when we want to present self-defense, which only is a burden of production, we need direct evidence of self-defense before any circumstantial evidence can come in. And I reject that. This court has never said that. That would be a major departure from this court's jurisprudence. Bottom line, you can get a jury instruction based on your theory of defense, based on circumstantial evidence, no matter how weak or incredible. You don't need direct evidence in order to justify getting a jury instruction. And her behavior in the months, the weeks, the days leading up to what happened is certainly relevant. You can make the circumstantial leap between, okay, she did these things to him, that might have affected his mental state on the night that she died. How is that any different than what the state does in, say, a burglary prosecution? In a burglary case, should the defendant have to testify first, I didn't have the specific intent to steal when I entered the building, before he can present all the other circumstantial evidence showing he had money in his pocket, he wandered around the store for 17 hours. This is not the state of the law. And I know he's trying very hard to justify this by saying, well, it's condition precedent. No, her behavior through the other witnesses is the self-defense evidence. Bottom line. So there's no need to force him to testify, to waive that very valuable Fifth Amendment right. There's no reason why Delaney has to interfere with the attorney-client relationship and say, I'm not going to let you converse with your client about the strength of your case, the deficiencies in your case prior to making a decision. You need to say right this second. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I got a little fired up. Do you have a question?
I appreciate the passion associated with the argument, and it's... As I mentioned at the beginning, it's an important legal question for us to take a look at, and I appreciate the advocacy of counsel on this point. I think we understand your argument.
And one last thing. I'm sorry. 48061 is hugely important in this case. I don't think it got enough, consideration by the district court. Thank you.
Well... we aren't able to show the same level of passion that both of you display, but I think we fully understand
Thank
the arguments and the briefs that have presented the question, and it will stand submitted. Thank you.
For